This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code DATANAUTS30.
As the intergalactic Datanauts cruiser prepares to warp into uncharted territories, we pause to edit the configuration settings for our jump drives. But lark, my friends, lark. Two of our red-shirted officers are trying to make changes at the same time, causing conflicts and riding over one another. Is it possible to find some sort of version control system to aid them in their nerdy efforts? Will they survive the ordeal? Tell you what, set your brain phaser to stunning as we embark on a quest to locate a new home for our project. Welcome, I am Chris Wall. You can follow me at Chris Wall. And with me are Greg Farrow, he's at Ethereal Mind, and Drew Conry Murray, a.k.a. at Drew_CM. And this is, as expected, the Datanauts podcast. You can find this and all of our shows on iTunes, in your favorite podcatcher, or at packetpushers.net. And as we alluded to a little bit earlier, we're going to talk about version control. It's certainly not anything specifically new to the show. We've hinted about it, we've talked about it, we've skirted with it and flirted with it in the past, but today we're going to square on, attack it, so to speak. And with me are two of my favorite friends, Greg and Drew. Say hello to the Datanauts audience.
Hello.
Hello, Datanauts audience.
Awesome. What did you guys do with Ethan? Where is he at right now?
He has to recharge every now and then. So he's off in the wilderness, tromping around and playing with gadgets at the same time.
He likes to walk up and down hills. I think he's
so it's like being at a conference, but without the conference.
Yeah.
Walking.
Or the people.
Or the people, but add in hills. So it's almost exactly the same except for those things.
All right. I just wanted signs of life. I wanted a photo with him like a current newspaper or something, but it sounds like he's well and safe.
He's fine. He's absolutely fine. Stop asking.
Actually, I don't know if he's well or fine because he just hasn't appeared. I mean, I haven't seen him on social media. It's like, maybe we should send out a search party and get a proof of life. What do you think?
It's just... That sounds expensive and less interesting than talking about version control. And specifically, what I wanted to start bringing up was the topic of Git. When I was doing some research for the show, I found the first thing that you find when you search just Git, and that's G-I-T, is a definition that sounds very Greg-like to me. Isn't that the version that you use over there?
Yes, someone who's a Git is an unpleasant person. They have these different words, and Git's one of those words, like... Polite. It's not a cuss word, but it's definitely not uplifting. And that is exactly one of the things that was alluded to when the name was announced.
Interesting. See, I'm learning all the time. So when I was doing some research, I'm like, okay, that's not what we're going to talk about today. That's the wrong definition. What we're going to talk about is the use of Git as a version control system, which is commonly just abbreviated as a VCS or a distributed version control system, which is a DVCS. This is certainly nothing new. Git and a lot of others have been around for a while. I only recently started using Git over the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, which feels recent for me. Historically, I was using this awesome, wonderful piece of software that the sarcasm is just oozing out of me called Visual Source Safe, or VSS, which is another one of those acronyms that has cross-pollination with other things. It has since died. I believe it is completely end of life, end of never want to use that again. And now it's all about Team Foundation Server, or TFS. Have you guys used TFS or Subversion or any of those before in the past?
I've used Subversion a fair bit, and its precursor, I'm trying to remember the name of it because I think I'm shuddering. Like, there's this. But yeah, I've used a couple of these over time. I've never used TFS or VSS, mainly because they're Microsoft products. And so my assumption is that they were uniformly awful and ran a long way in the different direction to get away from them.
I just love how polar opposite we are about Microsoft, that this is going to be fun.
I mean, I know Microsoft means well when it tries to develop products, but it always just seems the corporate process doesn't seem to enhance it. It seems to just take something away from it, and you end up with something you actually don't want.
Excellent. I think regardless of what tool that you use, really what we're talking about is just a way to store information so that you can track change. And hopefully the idea is to collaborate among your team on those changes so that it gives you a platform to not only introduce change, but also discuss that type of change so that you can track it. It creates a history and things like that, rather than just being kind of your own one man soldier of fortune or one woman soldier of fortune. I'm not good at the gender terms.
just one person of fortune.
One person of fortune. going in and making changes and just telling people, hey, I made a change, they have to trust you.
So it's all about the text files, right? You've got to have a text file. Well, it doesn't have to be text. You can actually check anything in or out of a versioning system or a content versioning system. You put the file in, you suck the file out, and then you can see what's changed because you have a milestone or a checkpoint. So you push your text file into the Git or your favorite version control system, and then somebody else makes a change and they push it into the version control system, and then you check it back out. And lo and behold, you can tell what's changed since last week to this week. And hopefully when they did the check-in or the check-out, they attached a comment to that to say, why did they put it in? Let's say you're doing a plain text file of some notes, maybe a wiki entry or something, and you put a note on the check-in saying, following the changes to the system last week, I've updated the documentation. And then you can then go to the version system and say, I see some changes have been made. Who made them? Oh, I see that was Chris. Following the system upgrade last week, he's updated the process note so that now we have a new runbook. And that's the sort of thing I've used it for, is runbooks, actually.
Excellent. Yeah, and you're right that it can be anything. I think text-based information is quite popular as far as what you put into a repository or what you put into the folder of stuff that's being tracked by Git. But certainly you can put anything that's quote-unquote artifact, meaning a thing, can be put into the system and tracked. But it's nice to see text information because, like you said, you can see specifically what changed kind of a binary level.
Yeah.
A word got changed or a paragraph or something got introduced, et cetera.
Yeah, when Linus wrote Git, the intention was he wanted a way to manage the source code of the Linux kernel. Most of the design is predicated on the assumption that you've got a plain text file, which is code, push it in, pull it back out, and then you can diff the two and see what changed between this week and last week, or, you know, last year and this week, all the changes in between. As I understand it, that's the root of the challenge. So it works best for text because you can see the differentials, you can diff two versions. But it works for anything, images. You can check in an image, check it back out, and then you take it out and say, has this changed over time? So maybe you've got an image called something and somebody's checked it out, done some modifications to it. Maybe they've changed the contrast or boosted the blues or something like that. And then they check it back in. You can't see that when it's text, but you can when you check it out. So anything is possible in Git because everything's just binary in a computer at the end of the day. It works best for text.
So version control systems have been around for a long time. What is it about Git and GitHub that's made it so popular that it just seems like it's kind of leapt out and eaten the world?
I'll put on my kind of newbie with a beard hipster perspective. One thing I like about Git, as opposed to when I was using VSS and TFS, is that it's distributed, meaning it's not a client server model. I mostly instantiated and ran the backend for TFS and VSS for developers, which means I had to build the servers and manage the code that's running on those servers. And, you know, the typical operational headache of keeping something running. That also meant that you had to have access to the server where the changes were, so you had to VPN in and grab it, and it was kind of a headache at the time, and this was 2008, 2009. With Git, it's distributed, meaning that anyone can run the truth in the code on their workstation, or you can sync from one workstation to another. There's no need for a master server. It's quite handy to have that because you could just say, okay, I want to write something. Maybe it's a text file, maybe it's code, whatever, on your laptop. Create a Git project and repository around that. Track it and then sync it with a friend that you have no relationship with from an enterprise perspective. It could just be a buddy or you're at a meetup or something like that, talking about Docker config or something. And you can work among each other without having to instantiate any sort of server, which I really like. And it uses the idea of branching in quite a fluid way. And just to talk about what branching is, the idea is that there's always a master branch within Git. And master is the golden copy of information. Should be stable, should be production ready. Someone should be able to go to your master branch and pull whatever's out of there and use it and not have to really worry once the project's at a certain level of maturity. Any changes that you want to make to master get their own branch. Those are usually called feature branches, or at least that's how I use it. Let's go back to Greg's example. We had this wiki or this informational page. Perhaps there's a new version coming out where you're going to introduce a new server and you want to talk about that new server for the wiki. You can make a new branch that you could literally just call, going to talk about the new server, write all the changes in there, and then say, here's information on the new server. I'd like to pull those changes into the master. And people can look at those changes and say, all right, you added information on this new server, but you forgot an IP address or something. Please go fix that before you put it in the master. So it gives you this opportunity to pause for a moment, look at the changes, discuss them, and then pull them into the master. While master remains this kind of golden image.
And when you set up a repository, is there a hierarchy in place so that there's one or X number of people who get to decide what goes into a master?
There should be project owners and managers and things like that. It's really just folks that have write access to master can ultimately decide what gets pulled into it. So it's pretty easy permissions, read, write, and that kind of thing.
Well, it's a little more complicated, I think, maybe if we dive into that a bit more. Imagine if you're not used to working in Git or text files, think of a Word document. And let's say somebody emails it around and there's 10 people get a copy of the Word document. And then they all make their changes and then they send them back to you. Now you've got 11 documents. How do you merge all those documents back into one? You've got all of this text. You've got all the changes that all of these 10 people made. And they've all done them simultaneously or over the period of a week. And normally some poor idiot has to sit there and merge them back together. And there's a rudimentary feature in Microsoft Word. And when I say rudimentary, I mean doesn't actually work very well. That sort of can help, but it's not very good at it. Well, in Git, what happens is everybody checks theirs. It would take a copy of the file, put it on their local machine, and then work on it. And then when they're finished, they'd push it back into the central repository, right? They'd all check it back in. So everybody's got a copy of the repository on their computers, and then everybody checks it back to a central or a given repository, any repository at any point in time. And then you've then got the ability to use your tool to check them all out, all the different versions, and then merge them together. So there's actually merge commands that you can now run to accept or not. That's the massive difference between normal ways of doing things in Microsoft Word to using a distributed versioning system. It allows you to merge stuff together into one.
True, true. And what I like is that the merge features, it's pretty intelligent. Unless two changes overwrite one another, have a conflict, that's specifically the word they use, it'll say, these are good to merge. There's no conflict here. You can make that merge. So if 11 people changed 11 different pieces of the file, as long as there's no conflict within them, it can just auto-merge. And if there is a conflict, it'll say, here's the specific part that has a conflict. Which change do you want to bring in? Both, one, none, etc.
You decide.
So it really gives you granularity over that, yeah.
It's so very much in a programming sense, you'll have a piece of code. Let's say you've got 500 lines of code. Some people might add subroutines. Some people might change lines, might change your logic. So somebody has to own the decision to merge it all back into one. Very powerful for teamwork, not designed really to add any value to one person's work, I don't think, although sometimes we use it for that.
So Drew, you asked about Git and also GitHub, and the relationship there is that GitHub is a hosted service for running Git. It's essentially someone else's repository that you also have control for in the cloud, and they add a lot of other features around it. So Git is ultimately just a command line interface. It's a CLI tool, and that can be challenging for folks that this is a new thing for them. I know for me, I was like, what is this? This thing is crazy. So they add a nice little web GUI around it. They give you the ability to create a web page and a wiki for your project. They have a lot of really snazzy online help, and you don't have to instantiate anything yourself, right? So you just basically put in a username and password. It builds everything for you. It kind of holds your hand. They have nice web and also GUI tools for your operating system. And they offer it in two flavors. There's a free model, which just about everybody uses. That's the cloud model. You can pay to make your repository information private. But if you're doing the cloud model and it's public information, you don't pay a dime. Or you can also pay if you want to bring it all on-prem. If you want to install their software locally and still get support for it, that's called GitHub Enterprise. And that is an on-prem model for running Git.
So I don't have an option to keep my repository private if I'm using the cloud model? Anyone can see it?
You can make it private. Essentially, you're just paying for that feature. So by default, all of your data will be public and open and searchable. But on a per repository model, you can say, I want this to be private, and you pay a subscription fee of a monthly. I think I get 10 repositories private per month for like $8. It's really, really tiny. And the amount of information you can store in there is pretty huge. So it's a pretty good deal.
The reason, the business logic behind that is that having free stuff on there that other people can see drives GitHub's business. It doesn't have to do marketing, but you don't always want to have your stuff out there in the public. So if you pay, you get to access an enhanced service. So when you pay for GitHub, you get extra stuffs, but you also get the ability to make your repos private.
Using the cloud model but paying for privacy is pretty much the way that almost all the startups are doing their code. It's a way to host things but keep it private so that you don't have to run any on-prem infrastructure. It's just a very, very popular model for, we want to do version control, but we don't want to have it public.
Yeah, like one of the extra things that you get is the ability to host a blog, I believe. I haven't looked too far into this myself, but if you're just using the free one, you can't really host pages that are fundamentally equivalent to a blog or a static website. So if you're paying for it, you can use a static website, which is your local computer generates the website and then uploads it. GitHub will host those HTML pages for you. But you don't get that with free, but you do if you get paid. So So some thoughts that I've got here is Git is a general purpose tool. It's not just GitHub, which is what you hear about online. GitHub is a service that is hosted that everybody can use, which is great. And the second thing I think that we talked about here is that Git is not just about text files or code. Anybody can use it for images or Word docs or other stuffs. You might have to change your workflow a little bit to make advantage of those, but there's substantial operational differences between the free and paid. Understanding the distributed nature of Git is actually quite challenging. You need to understand that there's a copy of it on your computer. If you're using GitHub, there's a copy of it in GitHub, but you might have a private Git server inside of your company or maybe in your home office. You can just continue to sync all of those things together. It does take a little while to understand the distributed nature of Git, in that there can be 5, 10, 20 copies of a file, all just waiting to merge back. But it does actually work at the end of the day. It's just not always obvious that it does.
I love that Git is drawing its name from a British insult, and I think more tools should use this model. That would make things a lot more fun. The feature of paying for privacy also makes a lot of sense. This is, as a versioning tool, it's essentially a collaboration platform, a kind of collaboration platform. But if you want to be able to set up controls around it, paying for privacy makes a lot of sense.
Sponsorship break, folks. We're going to talk about IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV gives you access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. I've been to the site. I visited. I viewed a number of the videos. It is the real deal. You get 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content. New courses are added every single week. And you can consume these courses either live, because they're actually running live sessions you can tune into, or on demand. You can look at the archives, go through the library, and pick anything you want to. And you can view these with anything that you can imagine, Chromecast, Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, etc., of course, through the web in a browser or with your mobile device. Now, if you've heard this ad before, listen up. Here's some new stuff. IT Pro TV is now the first IT video provider with courses for sale through Amazon Video Direct. So subscriptions are still going to be the best value for you, but it's kind of cool that IT Pro TV is now available for purchase directly on Amazon. Now, if you're wondering, why do I care? What content have they got? They've got all the big stuff, the big names, like Microsoft Server 2016, MCSE. They cover ethical hacking. They get into virtualization, a lot of VMware content in there, cryptography, Metasploit, other such things that would be of immediate value to you if you're an infrastructure or security engineer, etc. Now, June courses, content that they've added here includes CCNA security from Cisco, VMware's VCP6, and then instructor Adam Gordon returns with Certified Ethical Hacker version 9. It's not just course material you get with IT Pro TV. You also get well over 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and then Transcender practice exams so that you know you're really ready to go take the real thing. And that's $109 value. All of that is rolled into one low monthly subscription price. And if you decide at some point, I don't want this anymore, they have a no-hassle cancellation policy. And by the way, corporate group pricing is available. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts. Use the code DATANAUTS30 and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account.
We've talked about what Git is, what GitHub is, and hopefully the folks listening have that baseline understanding of what it does and why you might use it. Let's dig more into how it affects those in the operations field, people that are doing engineering and administration and architecture and things like that, that are not developers, because I tend to hear that this is a developer tool and only Git and GitHub should be used by those writing code specifically. And I think that's total hogwash, mostly because I was in an operations role for a very long time. We tended to work in silos and we didn't use version control for any of our stuff really beyond SharePoint, which is, I mean, I'm kind of on your side from a hater-aid perspective, Greg, in that SharePoint is like the tool for Microsoft that I just can't get on board with. I had to run servers that had SharePoint on them and use it, and both sides of that sucked.
I just never managed to make SharePoint work for myself personally, but across the sort of 20 or 30 companies I've worked with over the last 10 years, I've never seen a successful deployment of SharePoint. I came to the conclusion that it's not just me.
Well, here's another issue with it. SharePoint, when you upload a file and you want to iterate upon it, you can only kind of make changes in serial. You have a version, someone checks out the file, they then can make changes. And at that point, the file is checked out. It's a client-server model. Yes. No one else can touch it during that process, which that doesn't work.
That's right. And that's the old way that CVS and SVN used to work, was once it was checked out, it was locked. And that's the distributed nature of Git. The only advantage of SharePoint is that you would know who checked the file out, so you'd know who to go and kick, unless they were on holiday. Yeah. Yes,
it was. Yeah. I remember literally you check the thing saying, notify me when Bob has returned the files. But for operations, that's not going to work. It would only work if you were a team of one or two. And I hope you're not a very small team like that, especially across all of operations. There's typically a lot more folks. I ended up writing this article, Why You Should Embrace Version Control for Operations, because I felt that even in the past, but especially now, as we're looking to make all of our information manageable and visible and collaborative, that's really the key word for me. Something that's a priority within the organization, you need version control. And I'm looking at infrastructure, kind of the long view, it's becoming much, much more declarative. All of the information is being stored in a JSON file or a YAML file or pick your poison, XML, hopefully not, I hate XML. Having that version control system becomes not a nice to have, but I think a need to have going forward for ops.
I think ops underestimates the value of tools. I think how many times have you seen operations where somebody's got a folder on their desk with a pen and they're writing notes in an operations book? It just doesn't work.
You're making my hand cramp just thinking of that.
Yeah, but I've seen it so many times. People sitting there and they have a, you know, and when they hand over to the next person, I've actually seen like help desks and operation centers literally hand a folder of current jobs on a piece of paper over to the next person.
Yeah, this brings to mind the whole notion of institutional knowledge, that when somebody leaves an organization, they're taking a huge chunk of knowledge about how things actually work with them, leaving a big hole. Maybe they had some scripts or whatever on their own computer and they take that home and essentially that's gone and folks have to relearn how to do some things. But with this kind of system, a version control system, one, it's a repository, and two, it's open and public and folks can get in there and take stuff and do stuff and contribute stuff.
Absolutely. So I'll tell you my biggest pain point having worked in ops and why I really liked version control, and specifically distributed version control. So when we wanted to make a change, we go through a very standard enterprise process called the Change Approval Board, or CAB. And I think everyone has a variation of this somewhere, because when you hit a certain size, the powers that be just feel that you need some kind of bureaucratic process to inhibit change. And people that have no idea what you're trying to change should be those that approve the change. So it just felt completely stupid to me. And I really hated the change approval board, because you're really just explaining to very non-technical people what you want to make as far as changes go. And all you really need to do to push those changes through is the part of the form that has you declare risk. Just don't declare risk, or minimize the risk. And that's all they're looking for, is will this change hurt something? So it's a completely bogus system that doesn't do anything. When you start modifying that workflow to be more around distributed version control, and you're working with artifacts like scripts and config management and tests, or even holistic creation, things like Jinja 2 templates and Terraform templates, now we're saying, here is the state of the infrastructure. I would like to make this change. And rather than writing out the change in a CAB saying, I'm going to make these changes, and this is what the change is going to do, and here's the risk for the change, and creating all this worthless information that will never be used beyond proposing a change, with distributed version control, you can make the change in a branch. It doesn't actually do anything. You're making the change locally to those files, those artifacts. And you're saying, here's the changes I want to introduce, and here's what it's going to do. And you can kind of declare what the change is going to cause, what's going to affect within the system. Discuss those changes amongst your team. And if they like the changes, they can approve it. And then everything that you just put all that effort into becomes reality. It gets merged into master, pushed out to the configuration for Puppet or desired state config or Ansible, whatever. And you have a history of those changes. You're doing the work up front and saying, this is what I want to change. You're talking about it with your peers, people that hopefully are more senior or have other perspectives within the environment. And then if approved, all that work that you did becomes the change. So it's not like you're having to do this twice with a change approval board. The CAB could potentially sit in and review the change if they want, have some kind of executive buy-in or an app owner or whatever that's on the team to look at it, but way, way better. I hated having to write out these stupid forms for everything. Like if I wanted to change a VLAN on a port for a switch, I'd write a cab file together and say, this is what I'm going to change. And all this just worthless time sucking, soul sucking stuff. You could tell it hurt me a little bit. And then I'd have to go do the change later anyways. And it took
what's the risk of, like as a networking person, somebody who's networking centric, but you know, increasingly server centric, you know, what's the risk of making this change? Oh, well, the firewalls could, you know, in the worst case, stop working. Oh, well, that makes it a category one change. And we're only allowed to do one of those every year. So we can't change the firewall until 2019 because we have a queue of category one changes waiting to go. I hate change boards. I think this idea of branching is really, really key, right? Because you could be sharing a project with other people in your operational teams, whether it's a runbook or a script to reconfigure a system, or it could be anything, really. And what you can do is you can all be working on it, and then you can all check it back in. And then somebody goes, gets together and reviews the mergers. Now, that's a classic coding programming thing. Everybody merges their changes back, and now you have to agree which one's the best code to drop back in. Now, in a perfect world, everybody's working on a different part of the text file, and it's all just fine. This is the distributed nature of Git, in that everybody's version can be just as equivalent as everybody else's. And that can be very hard for people to understand. I particularly like using Git for updating runbooks. So operational runbooks, like if the network fails, if the internet's down, check this, check this, check this. Oh, the email service failed. What are the things that you need to check? Because you can check it out, check it back in. You can see who did the check-ins and check it out. More importantly, if somebody wrote something that's rubbish, you can roll it back, right? You can go back to the file, get the copy from 2 weeks ago before Jason downloaded the file and wrote something which is completely incorrect because he didn't know what he was doing, and then put that back into the branch and then merge it back into the core, and away you go.
It's I like the idea of the runbooks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's an easy way to start. Plus, we're talking about making changes. There's another way to look at it as well, is getting those changes. So if everyone has a local copy and is kind of tethered to a repository elsewhere to check in changes, it's also really easy to receive all the changes that were made. You literally just go to the repository and say, pull it in. All of the changes are now on your local workstation. Every time I launch my version control system, every time I launch Git on my workstation, the first thing I do is go ahead and do a pull to suck in all the changes to my local workstation. And so as all these merges are happening and all these changes are happening on the repository, it's really easy to then get the changes, right? And something like a runbook is a really simple, non-threatening way to start with version control because it requires no code. It's just talking about what to do in the case of, you know, Meteor Strike or something like that.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to get started here. Sometimes you're going to have to change things. Like obviously using Microsoft Word may not be the right way to use Git. I would suspect that you should start thinking about writing in plain text because Git gives you a lot of capability. Remember we said it earlier, using plain text is a lot more efficient for this controlled thing. Think about if you're wincing at that and thinking, God, don't take Microsoft Word away from me. I won't know how to work, or my organization mandates that Microsoft Word is a thing. You can read plain text in anything, not just Microsoft Word. You can read it in a terminal, in Vim, by Notepad. Like my favorite thing to write on Windows is usually Notepad because it's a damn sight more reliable than Microsoft Word. It won't crash after 15 minutes.
Well, there's also been a pretty big movement towards Markdown as a, you know, way to create plain text files that also get prettied up when they get interpreted by a Markdown viewer or on the web. And you're right, with a Word doc, because it is a proprietary format, it'll tell you a change happened, but it won't be able to get to the binary level and say, here's the word that changed, because it can't peer into what the .docx file is.
The format of .docx is not readable by humans. It's only readable by Microsoft. There's two versions of .docx. There's an open and a closed, and it defaults to the closed version.
The other thing I wanted to point out was we talked earlier about collaboration. I like that you're talking about collaborating around something that's very non-threatening, plain text. By making these changes through a version control system, you really kill off tribal knowledge because all the changes should be enforced with a not just how are we changing things, but why. So obviously that's a process thing. You need to make sure that as people merge in changes, they are making comments and there's a discussion going on. And that's a sort of human-based process that you need to enforce. The system doesn't enforce it by default. But you can say, sure, you can make changes. You can ask those to be merged in, but explain what you're doing and why. That way, as people get onboarded, it's not like you have to remember 12 years ago why you did something. You can go to the version control system and say, well, here's the change and here's why it was made. And that's also great because maybe, we'll say 3 or 4 years ago, that change made sense. Today, there's technology, it no longer makes sense. And we can say, well, we changed it because we didn't have a chip fast enough to run XYZ thing. Now Intel has a new chip out. We don't need this change anymore. And you can revert it or iterate upon it.
Yeah, the number of times you've got a folder with some text files or a Word doc in it, and it's got March 2011, April 2011, May 2011. Do you know what I mean? You know, you just got these versions. That you need to get away from that. Like, computers are a tool. One of the things that you need to be thinking about is, how do you use tools to reduce the time spent at work? How can you get home on time? And the answer is to use automation. Now, there's more than automation of automating your infrastructure. There's also tools for automating you. How do you make your workflow better? Can you use your computer to do things in an automated way that you would normally do manually? Git is one of those tools.
You mentioned tribal knowledge, Chris, and one of the things that why tribal knowledge exists is because folks feel like I've got this little piece of information, this knowledge that makes me valuable and worthwhile to the organization. And if I share it out, that lessens my value. That's the attitude. Is there any kind of cultural or process back-end work that has to happen to make something like Git or GitHub accepted in an organization, or at least in a silo of excellence within an organization?
Silo of excellence. I love that. You know, what I ended up doing was more guerrilla warfare, in that I would just introduce it and I would start using it, and I would build up this kind of buzz around, like, oh, you're not using Git and this kind of stuff, and look what I can do. That's pretty much true for anything that I think you want to bring into the enterprise, is you just have to kind of do it. Obviously, don't try to burn down the place, but just bring it in and share it with just a few people. Make it sound like it's the coolest thing since sliced bread. You can't believe that this other person isn't on it. And just make it that kind of exclusivity sort of thing, because people want to be in the cool kids club. They want to be in on that new hip thing that everyone else is doing. They don't want to be excluded. And if you just go for that, it's more of a pull model, trying to pull them into this neat thing rather than cramming it down their throat. That's one way I've seen work. Alternatively, if you have a very open-minded, forward-thinking management team, and you can get them together across the silos to say, hey, this is something great that we can use, and you've got a few examples where it's been a win, that could also work for you. As far as your other comment, though, if you want to get promoted, you can't be a required cog within the environment. You know, if you want to move on to bigger and better things, you can't be the only one that knows how to do something.
If you can't be replaced, you also can't be promoted.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. No, despite your best intentions, that's the truth, right? You can choose where you want to be or what you want to be doing, but, you know, that's a thing.
And do you see something like Git being able to coexist with an ITIL-driven organization, with a change advisory board, with a CMDB in place? Or are they sort of mutually exclusive? Do they compete with each other?
I've done it. In fact, the last place that I worked that had it was an ITIL-driven environment, and there were service engineers and all these weird titles for everybody to match ITIL dictionaries. It doesn't have to be the, I guess, public-facing system. It could be what you use within your team, and then you iterate upon it internally and then promote whatever came out of it to the ITIL system and say, this is what we're going to do. And it's certainly something that you could use within your team as a starting point, just to make sure that you are building upon a config file or a wiki or a runbook or something like that, just because it does make life so much better for working within your team. It doesn't have to be the process and the workflow blessed by Arthur's round table of C-level throne chairs. But it's certainly a tool that I would use as a team. I think Greg said a little earlier, it's not necessarily hugely helpful for one person, although I use it just for me as well, because I make a lot of changes and I have kind of memory lapses and I can't remember why I do things. But certainly among your team, it's a very helpful tool.
Git is one tool out of many possible tools that can be used to increase your personal productivity. A lot of people don't spend time using their computers and the computer systems that they have in front of them to increase their productivity, and Git is one way down that path. It's all about personal productivity that can actually enhance your job, not always about technology and knowing stuff, right?
My impression of Git and GitHub was that this was essentially a developer tool. It was for developers, it was for folks writing code, but as we've talked about in this section, there's significant operational benefits too. You can include scripts, it can be config files, run books, plain text, and you still get kind of a workflow element in there. If you need sign off, if you need some justification, you can make comments, you can integrate it all together. So it's not just for developers, it's an operational tool as well.
Yeah, you've got to be flexible about how you approach any technology. How can you use it to enhance your business? And Git is just another one of these tools. And there are lots of people out there who are using it for the most amazing things. You should be considering doing that for the same reasons as they do.
So we talked a lot about, one, what Git and GitHub are, and then how it applies to the ops team, not just dev. Chris, you're going to help us out and give us some resources for how, if you want to dive in, what you should do.
Sure. And this is the process I use, so your mileage may vary. I'm probably more of a simpleton than you guys are. So you may be like, well, this is too easy. I'm going to move to the more advanced stuff, and so be it. The first thing I want to emphasize with Git, GitHub, and that kind of stuff is start simple, and it's a lot of fun. You'll be amazed how cool it is to work with a version control system. It sounds kind of weird, but I have a blast. Maybe I'm just weird, although I know that.
I'm with you. I actually think Git is hugely good fun, although I'm already fortunate enough to be working in plain text files, and so it makes it useful. But I'm working on non-critical stuff to get started, and it's fun checking in, checking out. I almost feel like a real programmer or something some days.
Yes, got my big boy pants on, doing some Git.
I'm all up there with that.
So the first thing I would recommend is before you even go on GitHub, just start simple, start small, put Git on your workstation. I'm a Windows guy and I run the Windows operating systems at home. So what I ended up doing was I went to GitHub's website and they have a GitHub for Windows installable. And so if you install this application on your workstation, it'll install the GUI version of Git as well as the command line or Git shell version of Git. Since Git is not a natural part of Windows. So that's the application you can install if you're a Windows person. Otherwise, if you're running Linux, you just would want to use your package management tool to grab Git, or it may already be there. Do something local. Create a repository in a folder, which basically a repository is just a folder that contains files. So go ahead and make one and put something in there, a config file, a hello world, something really simple, and then iterate upon it the proper way. Go ahead and create a branch. Everything in there, you can do Git help, and then the name of the command, or just Git without any arguments, and it'll tell you all the different commands available. So create a branch that's not master, edit that file, and make some changes. And one thing I like seeing is as you change over from the new branch you made, we'll call it the feature branch, back to master, you can see the file on your workstation change. You'll see it go back to the original state and then the change state. And that's cool. There's actually a .git folder that's hidden that tracks all those changes for you. So there's a lot of value just in that. And then use Git to add in the changes to that particular feature branch, commit them, create a comment. And when you create the comment, here's the format I recommend. It's a very popular format for commenting. Imagine saying out loud, if I pull in this change, it will fill in the blank. So if I pull in this change, it will edit the file with a new server name or something like that, or add server X to the document. And that way, all of the comments read much more human readable, and they're all standardized and things like that. Try to use good comments. There's a funny commit strip or a XKCD, I forget which, comic, where it shows the timeline of commit changes, comments. And it's like, this will edit this file and add this IP. And by about 4 hours in, he's like, changes are happening. You know, the comments just get really horrible over time because the laziness goes pretty hard. And then approve your change. Make a pull request. Approve it, merge it in, and push those changes somewhere else. And that's really the whole system at a basic level. All the stuff around merge, conflicts, and things like that, you'll learn that in time. You'll hit that, and I'm sure you'll blow things up.
You can do all this on your computer as well in a single directory. So once you've installed the Git tools on your favorite computer, you can do all this in a single directory in the local repository, as it's called. Create a file, check it in, check it out, create a new file, add it to the directory, stage it. And then client, you know, all that stuff. You can do all that on your local machine. You don't have to do it in public. Where if you're scared of people looking at you and judging you and you don't want to do it in public, do it all on your local computer as far as you can go first.
Absolutely. In fact, I would not recommend going public at all in the beginning because it's a friendly ecosystem, but it's really scary at first. And I didn't know what I could harm. I didn't want to blow something up or screw someone's project up, even though that's not really possible after I learned the system. But totally. Run it on just your workstation and play with it locally. When I say push the changes somewhere, it could be to another workstation you have or another server that you're running or a friend or something like that. Oh. And in fact, the other thing I coupled with that was the course called Git Real, G-I-T Real, a company called Code School, which is owned by Pluralsight, has the course. It's free. They have more courses after that. There's a Git Real 2 and Git More Real or something like that. It costs a few bucks. But what's nice there is it's just this web platform that teaches you the standard commands for committing and branching, things like that. So that would be my recommendation for starting out, just learning what the heck is this silly Git thing and how does it work?
There's a really good tutorial, if you want, 15-minute tutorial on the GitHub website itself. So if you go to GitHub and then right down at the bottom, github.com, then right down the bottom it says some training and it goes GitHub Services, which is a sub-website. And then right down the bottom of that, there's a first thing. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's called try.github.io. It's got 15 minutes of walking through all of the basic commands of Git in a web browser, so you don't even have to do it for reals. So you've got no excuses not to just very first start out, right? It's a really great website, and the little challenges, you type them in. I've done it about 20 times because I'm still struggling with some of the concepts behind GitHub. Great starting point. And then I stumbled across this one. There's a link in the show notes. A guy called Roger Dudler did a Git guide, which is like, if you're somebody who's sort of very familiar with programming and nerding and sort of doing stuff, maybe you don't want to spend a whole lot of time on basics and you sort of, you know, I want to go straight to the advanced stuff. The Git guide basically outlines it in such a way that it makes it really easy to understand. So I can recommend that site to you. That's the Git guide that he's put together, because he just sums through it and he's done a nice bit of graphics and some words on it to make it nice and easy.
Fancy. There was a time none of us knew NXOS or iOS or anything like that. You didn't know config T. I mean, it's the same kind of principle. You just got to learn the syntax, learn the process, yes. and away you go.
If you've been doing a bit of programming and stuff for a while, you don't really want to spend your time working through the dumb stuff. You want to go straight to the advanced stuff. Of course, I went to the advanced stuff, then learned how stupid I was and went back to the basic stuff. But that's fine. You know, everybody learns in their own way, right? Yeah.
The other thing I recommend strongly is make a GitHub account. For a lot of folks, it's kind of become the new resume, the new CV is your GitHub account, because I can see what you've created, but also your process behind it. So it kind of peers into your mind a little bit. Go to github.com, sign up for an account. It's free. I recommend a few things after you create your account, even before you add any information or projects or repositories to it. Enable two-factor authentication. It's always great to do 2FA so that as you put information on there, not only are you assured that no one's going to delete it or things like that, but they're not going to slip in malicious merges or something like that, so that you inadvertently become a honeypot of malice to the world. Add a profile, add a headshot, try to jazz it up a little bit, make it look legit. And what I ended up doing when I first started with GitHub to learn it was I had a pile of a couple hundred Power CLI scripts that I had written to just do little one-off tasks. I went through and found some that I made sure they didn't have a password or anything scary in there. I didn't want to accidentally share corporate secrets. But just these little scripts, I ended up putting them into a GitHub project. And I didn't worry because they were not amazing. They were not sexy. They were written just for me. But I just put them up there just to have them. And then I iterated upon them using the process of Git. You know, I make changes locally, track the changes with Git, fix them up, make them snazzy, make them more friendly to those in the public. And then I'd continue to change them and commit them using GitHub. So it was a way to kind of, I needed to do that work anyways. It's just now I was doing it on GitHub, which is more hipster. My beard grew an inch every time I did a commit. So I looked like Santa Claus by the end of the day. And if you're looking for how to use GitHub, guides.github.com has a great thing on what they call the flow. So it's GitHub Flow. That's the workflow that is promoted by GitHub for, you know, using their online tool. So there's going to be a link in the show notes for that as well. And Atlassian, which is another kind of a competitor to the folks at GitHub, but they have tools like Jira and Bitbucket and things like that. They've got a great tutorial on Git and version control that we've also put in the show notes.
So Chris, I want to ask you, you mentioned that your Git repository is sort of becoming a resume. Does that mean you want to think about the kind of public persona that you're portraying in terms of like your headshot and the comments that you're making and so on, or just let it all hang out?
So my personal theory there is I try to keep it professional because I'm not looking to work as a developer at Google or something like that. And I imagine they have a different way they set up their profile, or maybe it's not even cool to have a headshot. I don't know. But for me, I like it to look like I give a crap about what I put on there, because I'm trying to instill some trust for people that want to download my code, as well as for people that perhaps are looking to work with me, or before, back in the day, looking to hire me. Just seeing what I'm doing and how I'm putting together the comments around my changes and the README files that are grammatically correct and they look proper and things like that. So I think it's two things. It's one, those that are potentially going to contribute to your projects. If it looks like you care, they might spend their personal free time to help contribute to what you're doing. But also those that are hiring organizations that are looking for someone that knows automation and orchestration, and they've got stuff on GitHub, and it's real. People are looking for people that know this sort of stuff. It can just help you if you look a little more professional and like you care, versus someone that has just the default little digital profile pic that it auto-generates. You just have plus one more point than they do. So it might be enough to get you the job.
From my point of view, increasingly we are expected to have automation examples that we've done or developed or contributed to. And having your name on open source projects is one way to get into what we call an advanced job today, if you want to move on or move up. having examples of the sort of code that you've written for whatever purposes up on GitHub. Now, of course, you're going to need approval from your employer if you're talking about internal stuff, but maybe do stuff for yourself at home, you know, some automation to show that you can hack a Perl script or a Python script and then run some regex. And this is what you did. You maybe took a code, a copy of a router config, or you pulled down a, wrote something around an API, just sanitize it so it's got no work information in it, and drop it up there and say, you know, this is how I did it, what I did. Put some comments in the code so that if I'm checking your resume and deciding whether to employ you or not, guess what I'm looking for? I'm going to go and look at your GitHub. I'm going to look at your Facebook and your Twitter account. And from Facebook and Twitter, I'm going to make an assumption around your personality. And from your GitHub, I'm going to know that you can write code if that's what you claim to. I'm with you, right? GitHub can be a living resume. And also, people will come and find you. So if they find your code and use you, maybe they'll come and hire you.
Well, it's been fun nerding out about GitHub and how it works for ops. It's certainly near and dear to my heart. And that's it for today's edition of the Data Knots podcast. I know, time flies. If you're a social creature, you can follow me. I'm at Chris Wall on the Twitters, and my blog is wallnetwork.com. We also have Greg. Where can you be found on the Twitters, and what's your blog?
You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com, podcasting at Packet Pushes. And I just wanted to point out that Ethan's chair is a bit weird. It's kind of odd-shaped. He doesn't have the same padding as me, so maybe that's what it is.
Fair enough. And Drew, where are you at on the social space?
You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM. And if you want to read my blogs, you can find it at packetpushers.net.
Excellent. And for more of our Data Knots shows about infrastructure engineering, nosedive down the rabbit hole that is packetpushers.net. You'll find the Data Knots talking about containers and certs and conferences, PowerShell, GitHub, moving to the cloud. If you subscribe, you'll have days worth of content. You could be like Ethan and go on a hike and just listen to our podcast the whole time. Until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindle spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
I use graphical tools. I don't use the CLI at all.
Yeah, so you're that guy. You're so unhip. You have a torso that turns into legs. There's no hip at all.
I'm so unhip, Mike. It's a wonder my bum doesn't fall off.